I would love actually to spend the next hour and a half talking to you about your books. And I'm just so happy. It's like, look at that. Had I made it to the West Coast, which I never did for school,
Yeah.
I'm sure it would have just been marvelous to sit at your feet and talk about all these things and read about them. And I'm very interested to hear. I mean, I know we're not supposed to be talking about this, but I'm going to ask you at some point,
Yep.
your life experiences and your Swarthmore experiences and how that led you into this wonderful proliferation of great criticism about economics in the South, which hasn't changed a bit almost, it seems. But I mean, yeah, but
Yeah.
it's just put on different clothes now.
May I ask another roundabout question? Are you familiar with Heather McGee, who wrote a book? Oh, what's it called? The Sum of Us, or something like that.
Yes, I have that book.
Well, it's a fine book, but I was it took a few years to come out, and I look in it. There's my name, and there's my name on a list of Zoom interviews that she had, and that was my very first Zoom interview before the pandemic, and we all started using it. So, I guess you're a Zoom person too.
Well, yes, I'm very much an introvert, very much a nose in book kind of person, and also a closet geek. I'm always on the computer from morning to night, and
Yeah.
for like 33 years now, I've been doing computer work. So it's marvelously convenient, especially when you're trying to talk to folks on the other side of the world. I was on talking to some folks in Africa this morning, so
Oh
it's
my
a
goodness.
beautiful
Well, good for
thing.
you. But where are you located, if that question has any meaning these days?
Well, as unfortunate as it is, I am in the southern seat of civil rights in Atlanta, Georgia.
Oh my goodness.
Yes, indeed, where we have just now had the crazy governor who I am unfortunately named, we share a name,
Yes.
and he has signed this bill to kill up half the state. And so it's like, oh God, I have to get out of here before they kill
Yeah.
us.
But you have a San Jose affiliation, don't you?
I do. I am a graduate student in the Archives and Records Management program and the iSchool at San Jose. And I
Yes.
am so happy for that. I
Yes.
fought to get that, and it was well worth every moment.
Well, very good.
One of my greatest professors there actually teaches, or he's in the library at Stanford, and he teaches us Bit curator and some MS-DOS and how to archive and find very, very old documents that are on things that nobody knows what they are, like floppy disks and metal things and all
Oh
like
my
that.
goodness.
So if I had only met him 3 years ago, it would have changed some content in an archive I currently work in, and I would actually have that content and could have printed it and told people what it said. But alas.
I had the sad task of going through the office of a colleague who has Alzheimer's, and I'm finding a lot of those old floppy disks, and I have been tossing them out with the idea that they're not much use anymore. But you're telling me that's a mistake?
You don't have to toss them out.
Yeah.
You can take them to your library and oh, I'm going to call the professor's name in a moment. I might have to look it up because I haven't used it for a while, so it's gone. But oh yes, you don't have to throw that out anymore. You merely need to get a drive that reads it and that write protects it. It keeps it from writing over it. And
Yeah.
you put it into this program, a Bit Curator, and it can help you do all kinds of stuff like restore string files, those that start with the number sign, and
Yeah.
read those files a lot of times. So your Stanford library can.
Okay. I mean, you're way ahead of me, but I'll raise this with the archivist that I've been talking to.
Wonderful. Well, let us begin.
Okay. And
if you would be so kind, even though you're quite famous, please tell us your name and when you were in the class of Swarthmore.
I thought you were going to ask me my date of birth, because all the doctors and nurses want to know that. But I, my name is Gavin Wright, and I arrived at Swarthmore in September of 1961 and graduated in June of 1965. And I should mention, my wife is also a Swarthmore graduate. She's class of 64. She's sitting directly opposite me at the table here. But
Please have her join us.
Well, I'm sure she'll chime in. Maybe if she wants to join in the picture, she can do that too. But we both have in common, we come from the Midwest. She's from Detroit and I was from Minneapolis. We both arrived on campus having never set foot on the campus before. Those days of touring the colleges
didn't exist, huh?
It was much less common. And that was my first airplane ride too, that September of 1945. United had a special deal. You're going to college, you could, 61, you could fly a standby. And I think it was $40. So that's how I came.
Such a thing. I presume that probably your first flight was a lot better than my flight to Minneapolis in 1984 when I got to attend the Hubert H. Humphrey School for summer school, which I worshiped Hubert Humphrey. So I was just thrilled to step into some place with his name on it. But I had a marvelous, marvelous summer there. And I would never want to fly there again. And I would never want to fly to Boston because it's the most bumpy flight that you could possibly have. And
well, then I'm sorry to hear that, but I'm glad it was a good summer. You know, I have only, my family moved away while I was in college in 1963. Hmm. So I have only the warmest memories of those days. And of course, but one thing was a shocker. I too, you know, Hubert Humphrey was my hero. I thought I'm proud to come from his state. But I arrived on college and I found all sorts of criticisms of Hubert. It was and is a pretty liberal college. And so Hubert was not liberal enough for many of my fellow students.
I'm so sorry, because he was certainly liberal enough for us in the South. And
yeah,
I was raised with politics from the time I knew what politics were. I was raised to watch politics very closely. I remember when Richard Nixon and the 1968 convention and all the people running around fighting and carrying on. So
yeah.
Hubert Humphrey was like God to us. So I'm sorry you didn't.
Well, in 68, he was something of a hapless figure because, you know, he was going to run. He was vice president. He couldn't cross the president, cross LBJ on the Vietnam War issue. So that's a sad memory.
It was a sad time, an absolutely insane one. I would like to back up a moment before we pop into all the happenings of this period to ask you about any experiences prior to Swarthmore, family, church, what have you, that may have prepared you to become an activist.
Well, I'm a birthright Quaker.
Oh.
So you might say, within Quakerism, that term is probably obsolete. We now think, you know, young people should make their own decisions. But nonetheless, my parents were Quakers, and so I was raised in Quaker meetings. So that's probably the most direct answer to your question, which is I did have that background. But you should not think that that meant that I was any kind of activist to speak of. I was exposed to a lot of people who were. I remember this was in Minneapolis, the Uphoff family. Gene Uphoff was a freedom rider. And, you know, a lot of people misuse that term. They think freedom rider was just a generic term for a civil rights worker. But no, it was the group who went down to ride the buses and integrate the bus terminals. And I remember Gene taking his guitar with him to while away the time while he was in. I don't know if that plan actually worked out, but I knew, though, I do find his name. And so, in other words, I had some exposure. That's about as much as I would say in terms of my own background.
I have had wonderful conversations with your fellow students, and in asking them this question about half say that it was their Quaker background, going to Quaker work camps, but not necessarily any influence from the Quaker experience of Swarthmore that caused them to work. And then others are like you and learn to do the work or be interested in it from being exposed to some of the very vocal people who were on campus at the time.
Yeah.
So can you talk about any of those folks?
Oh, I'm a little bit in between. After my freshman year, I went back home to Minneapolis. I worked on a construction project making what seemed like a princely wage, $3.10 an hour. So I'd saved up some money. I thought, well, next summer I want to do something more interesting. And I was familiar with the American Friends Service Committee. So I put in an application for their summer project, but I had no idea about the South. I'd never been to the South. And not, you know, it was in the news. We certainly had some awareness, but I actually signed up to work on a project involving grape workers in California. That project was canceled. So as a kind of a consolation, they said, well, we have this other project on voting in North Carolina. That's why I went. In other words, it was pretty much accidental. And yet it transformed my life because I developed a lifelong interest in the South and in civil rights and trying to figure out, understand better the historical background to it, which I'm still working on after all these years. So that was, it's not that I had an intense interest in going to the South, but it was eye-opening in many, many ways.
Yes.
I arrived in Durham, took a long, somehow, you know, bus seemed to be the way to travel. My family was at a conference in Traverse City, Michigan. So I've looked at those records. It took me 40 hours to go bus from Traverse City to Durham. I arrived, you know, very sleepy. But of course, when I had using the bus in Durham, the first thing I did, looking, did the Black people ride in the front of the bus?
Uh-huh. And
that was without any local knowledge. I actually don't know much about the history, but, you know, I found didn't seem to be an issue. People were sitting everywhere in the bus. We had a few days of training, and that's when I first met Eva Clayton, who was then a young housewife living in Warrenton, North Carolina. And, you know, we had a few speakers. We heard from Eva and a few others. That'll give you a little bit of an idea, but the truth is you had to be there to kind of get some of the flavor of what that was going to be like. So I don't know, not too much of an answer, but the point is, I just found myself, okay, I'm going to have an interesting experience here. I don't know what it's going to be like. And that was my background.
Well, it's perfectly marvelous that you were open to the experience. You know, openness is the first thing on the list. I think that's necessary in order to have civil rights and human rights actually be the rights of the land. And so thank you for your openness. I can't help but wonder, because I have read how this occurs. When you were riding the bus from Traverse City to Durham, do you remember at any point, or the point at which the arrangement of seated people on the bus changed? Do you remember whether there was a point where you noticed all the Black people sat in the back and, you know, all the white people sat elsewhere, or no, were there any on your bus?
I have read many accounts like that, particularly people riding the train, but I have no memory of such a change. I do have a memory of, you know, I think probably we went through Washington, D.C. I did have a distinct sense of moving into the South, being different. It had a feel of being different. And certainly part of that was the visible Black presence in the populations and the people that we were looking at. It's quite possible that there were no Black people on the bus at any time during my ride. Because, you know, that was the one thing about Southern life that I was going to take notice of when I got to Durham. And as I say, I didn't particularly see, you know, I remember Eva telling us, now, you know, you'll observe Black people and white people with a lot of kind of banter going back, friendly talk. She said, don't be misled by that. You know, don't think that it's a warm, friendly relationship just because, well, you know, that I had to ponder that. Is she saying people appear to be happy with the state of things, but they're really not? And do I have to take her word for that? So on. But I did come to certainly that idea that people, whatever the state of things, they get through their daily lives, their work, their shopping and so on, one way or another. You shouldn't think that Black people and white people, just because Black people are discontented with the state of affairs, it doesn't mean that they're at each other's throats every minute of every encounter. I mean, I'm not sure you really could live very well if that were true. But at the same time, of course, we asked ourselves, how can we contribute here? And one of the ways was, well, maybe we're in better position to speak to the white community, to some of the business people, so on. We try. I'm not saying we had any great impact, but we did try that. And of course, it was true that the white people in Warrenton and in those counties really thought there was nothing wrong. And they thought the Black people were not discontented if it weren't for those outside agitators stirring things up. In other words, people like us. Mm-hmm. So that's... that insight, probably one of the things, maybe in a couple days of training, the white people were living with all these illusions and delusions, whereas Black people actually had a pretty keen perception. They knew what was going to be said. They knew how people thought. So there really was an asymmetry there in terms of perceptions.
Can you tell us any more about your specific trainers for your civil rights work? What kinds of things did they emphasize to you all besides kind of like the basic nonviolent tenets?
Well, there was a professor at UNC named Don Irish, I-R-I-S-H. He later, I think, went from there to Hamline University, which is in St. Paul. So he said, look, I'm not a Southerner and I don't want to pretend to be. He was not. In fact, I'm not sure any of the people we talked to were Southern. But yes, the lesson was pretty clear. there was a sociologist, and he was talking about, you know, traditional societies as contrasted to kind of modern urban societies, that there's, and maybe there's some of this had to do with Southern culture, saying, you know, he didn't, I'm sure he didn't use the word laid back, but it was the idea that social perceptions are different. A lot of kind of norms. If somebody says, oh, come over to dinner sometime, you must come over. You shouldn't say, well, okay, when? You know, that's the kind of a way of talking.
Uh-huh.
And the upshot was that our mere presence as an interracial group is going to be disruptive.
Mm-hmm.
We shouldn't be pushing the boundaries of social acceptability in any other ways that were unnecessary. Now, this the whole approach here was pretty darn moderate when you compare it to what was going on elsewhere. So I don't know that, but perhaps advice like that was being given to all most civil rights groups, not just nonviolence. But look, don't flaunt, don't get drunk, because there was no drinking in our summer. Don't make a lot of loud noise at night or whatever other things. Now, you know, we are an interracial group living above a Black-owned grocery store, Gaynell Brown's Brown Superette, and interracial intergender. So that very fact was enough for the townspeople to assume that all kinds of shenanigans must have been going on there. But other than that, we were polite, we were well behaved, and trying to be courteous in our efforts to communicate with the white community.
What were some of the reactions that you may remember that you saw from that community when they saw your interracial mixed gender group?
Nathan
Laundry.
Well, my wife is giving me a tip here to tell about. This is not quite a direct answer, but I'm going to show you a picture on my wall.
Okay. Here.
Let's see. No. You see, I have many. That one. That was a member of our group. Named Nathan Huff, and you can see the Wyoming sign.
Mm-hmm.
We actually attempted, we did have laundry, and we did attempt to integrate that white only laundromat.
Mm-hmm.
This was not Nathan, but a young woman from New Orleans, who was the one Catholic in the group.
Oh, wow.
And I only heard about this. This was some of the women. They walked in and just quietly started to use the laundromat. And this woman came over and said something, you know, what do you think you're doing? And one young woman was from England. She had an English accent. She, you know, feigned ignorance. Said, what do you mean? You know damn well what I mean, says this woman. And so they ultimately were told to leave, and they did leave and traveled quite a few miles to find a laundromat where that was not the case. Now that's probably as close as we came to a confrontation that summer. I mean, the whole idea was that we were kind of a warm-up, kind of spreading the gospel of voter registration, trying to convince people who had long since given up any hope that they really should look. And we didn't know the Voting Rights Act was coming down the line there. The whole image was the idea of people screwing up their courage, going in, facing down the registrar. The following summer, 64, there was a much more serious voter registration campaign. And I think that group and the service committee has been another group, and they had a much less of a free ride than we did. In fact, at one time, somebody shot a projectile into that apartment where people were living. Nobody was hurt, but you know, it was an act of, but as I think back, I'm saying we didn't encounter too much overt hostility. That isn't quite true. When I have a slideshow, I have a pair of slides. One is, we're advertising, you and your vote, know and so on, the series of ducks. And then the next day, that same sign shot through with buckshot. Actually, I've been saying buckshot. One guy came up to me afterwards and said, that's a squirrel shot, not buckshot. I thought he sounded like he knew what he was talking about. So I assume he was right. And it had a KKK. So that was, there certainly was a lot of unfriendly reception, let's say, to our presence there. But in all honesty, you know, partly it's because when you're young, you think you're invincible. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also the case that even though, you know, Warren County is a Black majority county, so it certainly was an area where segregation and suppression, voter suppression, was the rule of the day. It was not like being in Mississippi. And so I do not want to claim that we ever felt in mortal danger the way people really were in other locations.
I want to ask you something further about that. It has come, one of my favorite, I call it a recent publication, that explains more of what was going on behind the whites who came to the Deep South to do civil rights work. And that is that they were being protected by various people, the Deacons of Defense and a number of other people from different communities, who were quietly in the background holding their shotguns and negotiating with their locals to not harm you all while you were there. Do you know any of that, or have you heard any of that? Did anybody think?
Well, I think I actually do not think that there was such a, we had such a backstop in our particular case. I have read some, I think, the same things that you're referring to, and I have come to believe, yeah, there's a lot of truth in that. It was still nonviolent in the sense that they were trying to get this was protection for people to engage in civic activity like voter registration or maybe sit-ins. But yeah, I mean, I'm certainly aware that the, let's say it, the popular or the, there's a sanitized version of the civil rights revolution in which it's a thoroughgoing commitment to Martin Luther King's nonviolent principles and other Quakers like Bayard Rustin and so on. It's not that their commitment was any valid, it was any less valid, but yes, there was that reality that you are referring to.
It is this nonviolent stuff will get you killed by yes. Charles E. Cobb Jr. Yes. I love this book, loved it. I'm a history freak as it is. Yes. So when this came along, I was like, I never knew this. This is exciting because I was two when you were in North Carolina, I was two.
All right.
And by three and a half, I actually could remember and recognize what I was watching. I watched the whole Vietnam War on the TV, and I watched everything about civil rights on TV. And as a child, I could feel how very dangerous it all was, you know, how violent. I could feel that. And I wondered how it was that you all could make it through and not be killed, because after all, I'm a Virginian, so
yeah,
I know how this goes.
Yep.
What do you think about that now as you look back on it?
Well, are you asking? I mean, obviously.
I'm asking why you think it is that you were less attacked than would be some people after you. And
see, we really were trying to be honest with myself as well as with you. We were pretty non-threatening. One of the, you're asking about those 2 days of training or preparation we had. A couple of the speakers had previously lived in Warrenton, and they talked about, well, the editor of the paper, he's a good man, you know. And Eva Clayton spoke up and said, well, if he's such a good man, why is it there hasn't been a single coverage of our movement in that paper? It was interesting to hear kind of on the spot, this difference in perception. But that editor was quite willing to write about our project. Early on, probably in June, the month we arrived, he said, oh, you know, this is, I probably have a clipping of it, but I'll just go by memory. It was, you know, this group is taking a friendly approach, a kind of persuasion rather than, so in his own, you know, moderate way, he was trying to help ease the perceptions. We weren't leading marches. We weren't organizing sit-ins. We were talking about voting, and even that had a kind of preliminary feel. So this is why, you know, one reason I didn't particularly care to talk about this experience for quite a few years afterwards. And that's because, you know, I had an impression. My impression was this was going to be a long, slow haul here, bit by bit, little by little, you could bring people around, but it's going to happen. It's going to take generations. Well, 1 year later, there's a Civil Rights Act. 2 years later, there's a Voting Rights Act. Things changed. I thought, okay, I didn't. My understanding was, one of the themes in my book is a lot of people had that same idea. This is going to be, it's taken so many years to get to where we are, it's going to take the same thing. So it was a case of very rapid change, contrary to expectations of many very well-informed people. But I knew that my understanding was pretty darn superficial even then. But it was when Eva Clayton was elected to Congress, 1992, I wake up one morning, my wife calls my attention to National Public Radio and said, listen to this. And I know that person, you know, the very housewife that was helping them. Obviously, she was clearly an exceptional person even then. But the idea that she was actually elected to Congress 30 years later, it meant not that our project did it, but this movement did something. It was a lot more tangible than anything I would have expected at the time we were there back in 63.
You know, there have been several of those quiet, well, let's see what we can do sorts of movements that ended up changing the world. Yes. And of course, yours was one, and I'm very happy for that. We need some more now as we speak in the current environment we're in. So can you find the point at which you became interested in any kind of civil rights movement activity? Coming from Minneapolis, not knowing much about this, just being exposed, do you remember the point at which you decided, well, I think I'll go do this?
No, it almost came about in that other, the other direction. That is, I wanted to do something. And it could have been anything that would make for an interesting summer. But it was really just turning up in first in Durham and
not then being able to go.
that kind of gave me that orientation. No, I was never tempted to be a freedom writer. In fact, if anything, I had the same attitude of skepticism that probably the majority of white people had. They say, oh, you know, you're just going to provoke violence. You know, you can be pious and say we're nonviolence, but you're doing something that's going to cause violence. How can you really justify that? Well, okay, I was wrong. But I'm just saying my perception, my understanding, and my interest in involvement was no more advanced than you know, maybe the average person in a place like Minneapolis. But it did change my, well, changed a lot of things about the rest of my life. I don't know, at some point we should move on to the summer of 1964.
We could do that right now.
Because one thing we heard from many white Southerners, and it had enough truth to it that it kind of, you couldn't just reject it. Why are you coming down here to try to fix our problems? Don't you have race problems back where you live too? And of course that was all too true. And so Swarthmore College, you know what? One of the things that struck me, and I think my wife would say the same thing, the first right, we had maid service. Especially the men. The men required more, you know, maid service. But anyway, all these maids were Black.
Mm-hmm.
I think they mostly came from Chester. Yeah. Chester was just four miles down the road, but mm-hmm. it could have been 1,000 miles, except for the fact that it was providing a certain amount of work. Mm-hmm. And it's not that they were brutally treated. I don't know just what they would say in retrospect. But the point is, you had this striking racial segregation, hierarchy, and nobody seemed overly concerned about it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Swarthmore, like many other colleges, was at least beginning to try to take some kind of stock about the fact that the student body was also not quite 100%, but almost. So there was an active effort, and in retrospect, what do we have to do? To begin to recruit more Black students. And the idea there was, well, we need to start that recruit. And this part I think was sensible. You can't just start with the high school graduates. You got to start younger with the middle school. And so we had a program, the Swarthmore Wade House Summer Studies Program. It took a lot of planning, a lot of thinking about how it should go, but it was to bring middle school kids from nearby area, to expose them to life on college, to have some enrichment lectures from various faculty and from the students. And it was going to be an interracial group. And it would try to convince, of course, these were going to be good students, try to convince them that there was a realistic possibility that they could go to college. And maybe some could even go to this particular college. At least the college would be more open to that than it had been in the past. So that too is, it's a rich memory. I mean, the thinking was naive in the sense that I think there was some awareness that the northern cities were, if anything, closer to explosion than even in the south. But the idea was, well, maybe it would make a difference if there was a realization that at least some of the young people from these very poor urban areas could be going on to college. And now, why the idea that a handful or a smallish number of students of color going to college is going to fundamentally change life in oppressive areas, that's a naive way of thinking about it, but it's the idea that, okay, we know things are bad. We know that perceptions are bad. A lot of fear of the Black Muslims, you know, they were preaching that's kind of true. Anti-white and it's sort of thing where knowing a little bit increases the fear. I think if people knew more and knew more about what they were actually advocating, I think feelings would have been different. But such as it was, that was the project. And it actually succeeded to the extent that at least two of the campers from our summer went on to become Swarthmore College students. I wish I could tell you more about the whole trajectory of the project, but maybe you'll learn more, because this was a forerunner of the Upward Bound.
The ABC.
We didn't, we had no federal money, nothing. It was kind of locally funded. Wade House was I wouldn't call it a settlement house, but located in Chester. So they were our sponsor, but we insisted that it be integrated. So there were three drivers, three of us. I was one of the drivers. One group went to Chester, and of course that group was all Black. Another group went to a suburb called Brookhaven, and that group was all white. And then a third car went to Media, and that was the only car that actually had a mixed group that came back. But I would like to think it was a good experience, experience with lasting benefits for all, not just along the lines we were thinking, an interracial experience that would have been different from anything else that these young people would have experienced.
I wonder if you know if any of the descendants of the wait staff at Swarthmore became Swarthmore graduates.
That's an excellent question, and I do not know.
I think that's
have you asked somebody? See, the thing is, a college student, you're there 4 years. And, it seems like a long 4 years when you're there, but the truth is it's pretty short in terms of the history of the institution and the community.
But there is Ethel Waters.
Yes, Katha reminds me of, the singer Ethel Waters?
Yes.
His Eyes on the Sparrow.
Yes.
She wrote, she went through Swarthmore College on her knees because she was one of those wait people.
Well, I asked that question because I am a Hollins College, well, it is now a university. It was college graduate. So yeah. Essentially our schools are amongst a large consortium of very small private colleges, mine being all women, will always be.
Yeah.
And whereas your wait staff was fairly nearby, so they kind of drove to you.
Yeah.
Ours, our college being founded in 1842 by Charles Cock, Mr. Cock brought his slaves with him. And the wait staff of Hollins University was located on a tract of land behind the college, because it's not rural, but it was at that time in a very, very beautiful piece of land. And the wait staff lived, on the road behind that, close enough to be able to get to you, but also to be unseen. And it took a very long time for anyone of the descendants of that staff to graduate, but I happen to go to school with one. And now our college has gone gangbusters in discovering where people are buried and where we might have plowed over this and that and so forth and so on. So.
Well, I was gonna ask you whether Hollins had done much to come to terms with its slave.
Oh, yes.
And now it has. When you were there, was that any of that?
Oh, no. No. To this day, students of color experience racial, not even microaggressions, just simply aggressions.
Yeah.
And I think the Black student alumni really, really pushed very, very hard in around 2015 to begin not only recognizing the staff, but their descendants and their accomplishments, and more than their just their support. And from that time to now, the college has its first Black president, which when I saw that, I almost fell off the chair. I'm like, are you serious? Oh my goodness. And they have now created a working group that has donated money to the church, helped renovate the church, given scholarships to students, helped renovate the neighborhood, and have dug up as much of the college as they possibly can, where people may have been buried or lived, and they're putting markers and all this and that and the other. So they're really finally coming to terms. And the descendants of this original staff are still there.
Mm-hmm.
They're as loyal as any group of people could ever be. And I'm just so happy to know, because I am from Roanoke, and my house was literally 20 minutes away from campus, but my parents let me live on campus. Mm-hmm. And so it's just, it's wonderful, because that's my hometown. And, you know, the parents are, in fact, the parents were in the civil rights group that helped integrate. My hometown was very much like you were describing in Durham, where it was kind of an arrangement. Okay, we're going to do this on this day, and we're going to do this on that day, and we're not going to fight. And in Southwestern Virginia, it's almost unheard of that you didn't fight, because it's straight Klan country. So didn't fight. We just integrated. So it was an amazing thing. People do change, amazingly enough.
Well, you know what? I like the fact that you... you know about this activity on the part of your parents.
Oh yes.
A lot of people don't talk about this to their kids for one reason or another. But we had an interesting experience. You know, the Warrington Group, we had a 50-year reunion.
Yes.
2013. And one of the local participants, Dot Gill. It was only when some of our people arrived to help plan the reunion that her own kids learned about her background in this civil rights project. She hadn't talked about it. And she later said, you know, she was terrified. She was in it because her father insisted. He thought, here's an opportunity, and, you know, don't pass up an opportunity. But here we were coming in, mostly white. It was an integrated group, but she was local and very sensitive. And you know, we're coming in from these elite colleges and universities. But of course, we did become friends, and I hope that she would say it had a lasting impact on her, but not so much that she talked about it to her kids. So that's... Well, that's a lot of what you're doing is to
trying.
Yeah.
How much of the not talking about it anymore do you think, and you may not know an answer to this, but do you associate that with typical Black Southern culture, or do you think, why do you think she never said anything about it?
I'll tell you why I didn't talk about it much. It's because I was all too keenly aware about how limited our little project was. And if you'd asked me if it had never happened, the whole thing had fallen through, would it really have changed the course of history, even for that local area? I don't think so. So I did not want to seem to be claiming to be some kind of civil rights hero.
Can you claim it now?
I obviously I've changed my tune on talking. Well, I found that when I give a presentation, I want to talk about my evidence and the data, and I've got charts and graphs and so on. They want to hear about my experience. People do want to hear about it. Mm-hmm. So I've kind of reluctantly given it. They say, and they'll ask questions. How did your parents let you go? You know.
And I'm going to ask you, what did your parents say?
Oh, they were delighted. You know, they're part of the Quaker heritage. I imagine they were worried, but I didn't give them any particular reason. They knew the American Friends Service Committee was a responsible, reliable organization that would try to ensure the safety of its participants. So now, as to why Dot didn't talk about it, I don't. I can only guess. Yes, maybe it's some kind of traditional Southern, but you know, when you have kids, you begin to, it begins to sink in that when you start talking about the old days, they tune out.
I know this, it's unfortunate. I don't figure out to listen until you're about, you know, maybe 10 years older than I am now, then they figure out to listen.
Yeah, and there's a kind of a leap of faith. You want to convey at least some values and maybe some experience to them in the hopes that, you know, they'll remember it 10 or 20 years later when they have kids or something like that. But that's certainly part of it.
You all left at the end of the summer.
Yes, that's, again, my wife is giving me another pointer here. The fact, you know, we had our summer experience and then we left. Mm-hmm. And went back to our, you know, we may have gone back to other kinds of activism, but nonetheless, we were not, if there were any lasting consequences that were adverse, we weren't going to be there to experience them. And certainly that was the situation in many of the civil rights locations. The locals stayed local and the others kind of went home to one thing or another. So that was my experience. My reason was because just not wanting to claim more than I really deserved.
Well, thank you for being so modest, and you definitely deserve to claim that you were instrumental in making a huge change. Can you tell, what else would you like to tell me about your summer 64 experiences, if you have any more? And I also want to ask you if you ran into any of the sort of famous people who were, their philosophies were moving through the student body at this time. So do you have anything else you'd like to say about your summertime experiences?
Come up with something. Now, let me, I think your oral history project really is oriented towards the college and its record. Am I right?
Actually, my oral history project is really for the purpose of capturing the genuine experience and people's connections to various artifacts, locations, philosophies going on during the period. The students that I am speaking with are engaged in the movement all over the place. Some people went to Tennessee, some people went deep south, some people went further north and worked around, of course, in Chester and in Cambridge, Maryland. So
yes,
the idea that I'm after is, what was it like for you? What did Swarthmore give or not give to you in this experience? Did the Quaker background and religion of the college influence you? And then who were the people and what was the result for you today? I'm very interested in the last question because I'm old enough to know that it seems like we've gone in a very large circle. And I would like to know what in the world happened in the 60s while I was watching that missed the road some sort of way. And here we are again, and I don't understand, and I already did this, and what has happened? So that's kind of the focus of my oral history. And the questions are really based on those that were previously asked to the, I think it's 8 or 9 oral histories that they captured some years ago. Yeah. And that project stopped. And so I'm really going off that to try to give some continuity to the conversation, but also to beg you all to tell us all the goodies that we haven't heard yet.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to think, do a little bit of introspection. And I actually think I've probably not driven or influenced too much by the prevailing philosophies. In fact, I often find, I missed a lot of the what later were said to be, you know, going around the college campuses. I think part of the reason I chose to go into economics was I wanted to be engaged in a practical a dimension. That the idea of the race relations or racial understanding, I'm all for it, but it's practical, realistic changes in people's lives. Isn't that the bottom line? Or at least so I said to myself. I know you asked about 64, but I graduated in 65. I went up to Yale, New Haven, became a grad student in economics. And for a brief period, you know, I did a certain amount of tutoring. I was some kind of spillover of civil rights. But what happened to me, what happened to us, is similar to many of the activists of the time. Our energies transferred over to the Vietnam War.
And I was going to ask you that.
And that became almost an all-consuming passion. I said, how did I ever get through and finish my degree? Because my involvement, we did one thing or another. I won't give you a long list, but I do want to point to one kind of reconnection, which is, it dates from the McCarthy campaign of 1968. Mm-hmm. He was running as Democratic primaries. Mm-hmm. And in Connecticut, if you wanted to influence national politics, you had to organize locally. Mm-hmm. So we actually had a McCarthy slate of delegates elected to the state convention, and then they would choose delegates to the national convention, with mm-hmm. that notorious convention in Chicago. But we found, I'm just saying we, the McCarthy, I was nothing more than a foot soldier. They gave me one square block to interview, or go and knock on people's doors. And I went back, I did that. But you know, you do one square block, you're gonna miss a lot of people. So for days afterwards, I would finish my daily work. I would go back to that square block because that was the only assignment I had, till I had seen, I think, every single person on that. We swept the election. It's the illusion of easy electoral success. We cared more than the machine Democrats did. But we had the following problem. We are going into largely Black neighborhoods mm-hmm. and getting a reaction like, who are you?
And what are you doing?
We have our issues, our problems here, and you're coming around with your issue. Why should we listen to you? And it was a tough question. So I was got involved in local politics in New Haven, and we had a pretty ambitious ideology. Was it's going to be a coalition of the liberals based on Yale campus with a local Black group, so that we'll help them on their issues, and then they'll have a good reason to support us on our issues, which are more national.
Mm-hmm.
We even had a fair amount of success. We had a Black mayoralty candidate, Hank Parker. I worked on two of them. He didn't quite make it, but we elected 7 delegates to the city council, then aldermen, they were called. Now they're called alders. And yes, there had been Black delegates before, but they were loyal to the machine.
Mm-hmm.
Ours were independent. They were the first election. They were speaking up. They like gangbusters. Did this have a lasting effect on the whole situation in New Haven? I wouldn't want to claim that because the economy went through a tailspin after that. I hope it had a lasting effect on at least Black, active Black participation in political life, because now New Haven is going on. But, you know, just as the undergraduates move on, I was intensely involved. And that was very much an interracial political activity. We were there for 6 years total, so it seemed like a long, long time. Mm-hmm. But then we moved on, and I only have kind of a hearsay understanding of what happened in New Haven. But I do think, for me, it was an extension of my civil rights work. In fact, I would say it was civil rights.
It was.
And it was in a northern city as opposed to somewhere else. A northern city where I lived at the time.
And so maybe that is needed.
Yep.
Your organizing work that you have just described may seem as though it's very local to the New Haven area, but the model of what you did has perpetuated around the country, and particularly in the South. There's a hair's chance, if everybody doesn't kill everybody before then, but there's a hair's chance that Stacey Abrams could become the governor of Georgia. And if so, it is precisely because of what you described. And she's very quiet about it, but incredibly effective.
Well, you know, when Reverend Warnock was elected senator, mm-hmm. I know that there's an air of disappointment in what's happened with Biden so far, and I share the disappointment, but we wouldn't be looking at any of that if it hadn't been for those two seats in Georgia. Mm-hmm. And look at that, I thought back that one of the new senators is a pastor at the Ebenezer Baptist Church. There is so much poetic justice in that outcome that I'm going to enjoy it.
And he speaks like him.
Happens. And I do think it's made a dramatic difference. Yeah, we're in precarious times, but I have not given up hope for the South. You say you have to get out, but.
Well, I kind of, there's kind of nowhere to go in the USA right now.
Yeah.
I live in the Black Mecca. It's very, in some ways, it's very, very comfortable here. In other ways, yeah. It's very, very much like the plantation, just with different owners. And we are preyed upon mightily in the state. And that's unfortunate, just because we're the hugest collection of Black people in the Southeast. It's bad. And our ability to maintain our home of civil rights is under merciless attack at the moment. So we'll just have to cross our fingers and hope we can make it through.
Has there been much talk in Atlanta about Charles Blow's?
I love Charles Blow, and his article was absolutely the truth. I mean, yes, in some circles I'm in, which are not circles that most people would be in,
yeah.
But in some folks I know, yes, Charles Blow is absolutely at the top of the heap. And I think a few of those folks really do adhere to what he's saying. It makes sense. But on the other hand, we're still in the U.S., so that just only makes our target larger. And that I'm not going to lie, that frightens me.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm going to be a body, hopefully not stopping a bullet, but I'm here. And, you know, I'm going to try to educate, and I'm done educating, as I say. I don't want to teach in class anymore, ever. But I certainly want to capture history and write about it. I want to draw you back for a moment to ask you, did you have any central influences from Carl Whitman, from the Students for Democratic Society group, the Tom Haydens of the world, anybody else like that who you may have heard about in passing?
Well, with
smaller college,
with Carl Whitman, it was more than in passing. You know, he was a charismatic leader. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, I was a moderate person. I've always been a moderate person. I was not inclined to follow Carl Whitman on the Chester campaign, even though it was happening there. And I was sympathetic, but I just thought they're going off to Chester. Do they really know what the issues are and so on? Obviously, freely acknowledge I was short-sighted on a lot of things, and I certainly missed a lot of things that were happening. Now, you know about that Carl Whitman was married, even though he later came out as gay.
Mm-hmm.
And Mimi
Feingold
is a genuine civil rights heroine. She spent several years.
Okay. I'm trying to get to her.
Okay. Well, keep trying. I would love to connect with her. You mentioned the name. I guess, all I would say. There was a, you know, I mentioned that I was somewhat shocked to arrive at Swarthmore and find people being critical of Hubert Humphrey. You know, I was co-organizer in November or the fall of 1964, Swarthmore Young Citizens for Johnson Humphrey. In other words, I was thinking in terms of supporting liberal politicians as the most promising channel for practical. And here's Carl Whitman and others who were talking much more radical stream. And so being a mainstream liberal, I was to the right of center at Swarthmore in those days. Now, you mentioned SDS.
Mm-hmm.
Katha, my wife, mentions she actually was the secretary to Paul Booth. Paul Booth was a local organizer. Sad to say, he's died within the past 2 years. His widow is Heather Booth. She's not a Swarthmore graduate, but sure would be a great person to talk to. So that was the extent of our household involvement with SDS, was that she served as a kind of an assistant or secretary to Paul Booth. And you can look at Paul's career and say, there's a guy. It's not that he and I were identical, but I think he had the same kind of idea. Well, of course, he and Tom Hayden, the early SDS people, really felt, the crazies had taken over and they wanted to do something a little less crazy. But Paul had a brilliant career as a labor organizer and as a policy influencer in Washington, D.C. Tom Hayden, no, I never met him. All our years in Ann Arbor, whenever they referred to Tom Hayden, it was always Tom Hayden, former editor of the Michigan Daily. So he did have a kind of local presence but here's something that happened while we were in New Haven. We were active in the Quaker meeting, and one of our fellow members there was Staunton Lind.
Yes.
Staunton and Alice Lind were Quakers. Staunton Lind and Tom Hayden went off to Hanoi
with
Jane Fonda. They're trying to talk to the North Vietnamese too. And, you know, they caught hell for that because it really seemed like borderline, people use the word treason. They certainly weren't, you know, negotiating foreign policy, violating the Logan Act and anything else. But Staunton was, and he's still living. He certainly was a lifelong Quaker with a genuine, deep commitment to nonviolence. But nonetheless, that probably explains why he was a promising young American historian. He did not get tenure at Yale and really did not get an academic position anywhere. So he too became a labor organizer, much like Paul Booth.
It's interesting that your activism led you, well, the serendipity, I guess, of your activism leading you to Durham as opposed to California, where at essentially the same time, they are having their civil rights movement with Cesar Chavez and the farm workers. So we could have been having a very different story right now.
Well, that's true. I might have been two different people. But, you know, we all need to do what we can wherever we find ourselves.
That's the
I will tell you, my main area of interest in reform in California right now is criminal justice, which I see as a civil rights issue. And I have to ask myself, how did we let this happen? Mass incarceration. And I say we, well, maybe I mean liberals, white liberals, but you know, those 90s, the 90s, that was, well, it was happening over a longer period, but definitely happening in California and elsewhere. And we kind of let it happen. And I wasn't particularly paying attention because I knew there was a crime problem and somebody had to do something. But now we're trying to undo what we allowed to happen and proving it is not that easy. But anyway, so that's what I'm doing now.
Well, on the subject of your now work, can you talk to me? This is very interesting, and hopefully I'll have a summer break, in which case I'm going to sit down and read all of the books of yours I found, which I'm very excited. It's like, oh, I want to read this. Oh, so I would like to know how you ended up applying your economic studies to the economy of the South. It's an incredibly interesting subject, but how did you get to it?
Well, you know, I did not know. When I went to grad school in economics, I thought, okay, I know these issues are basically economic. I know I don't have the expertise to really figure them out. So I'm going to get a graduate degree in economics. I wasn't especially thinking about becoming an economic historian, but I found economics did not have what I was looking for. Oh, it had some good things. But almost the first year I was there, I got a chance to work with Bill Parker, an economic historian, and he had a big new sample from the census of 1860. Okay. And it was though he and Bob Goldman at UNC had put this together, and now they needed some young people, tooled up young people to do something with it. Well, that's like, you know, for a PhD student, somebody handing you an unutilized data set in the whole area. That's how I got into economic history. Trying to connect it all together. I guess I just felt that writing a thesis, and then I wasn't sure I was going to stick with economic history, but the slavery topic was a hot topic back in the 70s. So I was in position to get involved with that. And then I thought, well, okay, we're doing all this writing about the slave period, the antebellum period. Somebody should be asking, what happened after that? I don't mean, obviously, a lot of historians have written about that, but really they tend to divide into some people work on the antebellum period. It's a different group that works on the postbellum period. I want to try to look. So that's how I kind of kept going. Even after it wasn't kind of handed to me, I just thought, well, I want to. Now, there's a lot. In that writing, Old South, New South, that was my thinking as of the 80s. There's a lot in it that I can now see, I didn't quite get it right. I thought that after the Civil Rights Revolution, the race issue was behind us. I don't mean I was so naive as to think there was no race issue, but as a hot button political issue, it wasn't at the top of the agenda in the South. that the South was rejoining the nation and soon we would not have this regional division. Obviously, I was premature, but a lot of people were saying things like that in the 80s, because you had this new breed of moderate Southern governors and many senators at well who were saying, like Jimmy Carter, okay, the race issue, it's divisive, let's put it behind us and get going on the growth issue, because that's something where we can unite black and white. And actually that's my more recent message I'm writing. Don't forget about that period. Everybody quotes what Bill Moyers supposedly said to LBJ after the Civil Rights Act: we've given the South to the Republicans for the next generation. That is not what happened. Instead, you had 25 years of competitive two-party politics in the South, and it accomplished quite a lot. Yes, shot through with hypocrisy, but it accomplished quite a lot. Yes, only in retrospect was that a golden age, but compared to what how things have gone. Mm-hmm. Since the Republican takeover, boy, you know, those struggles back in that period. And I don't think it had to be that way. And I think it can turn around again. And yes, Georgia is indeed one of the states that I have a smidgen of hope for, just as you said about Stacey Jones. Actually, I have more than a smidgen of hope for the long haul. But for the near term, I don't know how Stacey hopeful I should be. Stacey Abrams, yes.
Well, on that note, and because our time is almost over, I would certainly like to have your opinion, given your experience and your lifelong study. Oh, my goodness. What are we going to do today? Yeah. Do we have any student movements? Is the idea of student movement dead? What are we going to do, Lord Jesus, about voting rights? And, you know, the fact that our crazy Supreme Court gutted the thing to start with, and then now we have MAGA. What are we going to do?
Yeah, I know. That, I mean, the Supreme Court really was, you can go back and criticize, but they were the backstop. There were limits to how outrageous people could do. And now, are they going to backstop anything at all? You have to have doubts.
Well,
so I wish I had a good, simple answer. One thing I need, I think this isn't this Stacey Abrams, the key to her success is going back to the door knocking period where I'm talking about 1964. In those days, a presidential election, you'd be mobilizing the whole student group. That was what we did. Sent busloads of students, well-dressed, well-behaved. They would knock on people's doors and try to turn out the vote. And that's the way it was in New Haven. I don't think that happens most places.
Oh, yes, it does. And that's exactly how she almost beat that demon Kemp the first time. He had to essentially steal it to get it. And now he will have to do the same thing. And unfortunately, Brad Raffensperger is no longer the, what is that position? I think the state attorney general.
Secretary of State.
Oh yeah, the Secretary of State. He is now no longer that. So as you are saying, the backstops are disappearing, but it is, you know, it is the habit of Stacey Abrams to do exactly what you said. Yes. To knock on people's doors herself and talk to people and build coalition. Because essentially, if people talk to each other, they would, you know, recognize that despite the fact that you don't like the way I look, we still both need to eat today. Yes. And we should work together on that.
Yes.
So we can only hope.
Well, we can only hope and we can do what we can. But whatever it is, let's write it down and be sure the historical record is.
Amen to that. Let's capture the history and pray people actually read it and think about it. On my last note, and I thank you so very much for your commentary today. of course, we are embroiled in an absolutely awful war with crazy Russia. It hurts me to all over my body to think about the fact that Jews in the Pale of Settlement, people don't even know what the Pale of Settlement is anymore, and they don't know about our Jewish heritage in this country and where they came from and what they went through. And the fact that they're getting it again is just really physically making me sick. And I think the problem is you don't read history. You don't pay attention to history. If you paid attention to history, you might have avoided this mess. So I can just only hope that the wonderful histories that you all are giving to us will continue to instruct not only students, but people in general, so that they keep going. As the new justice, I pray she gets to sit in the seat, says, persevere.
Yep. All right. That's a good note on which to end, because we cannot lose hope and we cannot stop persevering.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. I hope to thank you for what you're doing. And I hope to have contact with you again in the future.
I hope so, too. As a matter of fact, as I send you a thank you note in a moment, if you have not looked at the previous oral histories on the Swarthmore site, I will be sending you a link to that, so you know, presumably, where you will be able to see your content.
Tell me, are you working with Allison Dorsey?
No, okay. That I know of. Allison Dorsey?
She's a professor of history at Swarthmore College.
Ah, okay. So no is the answer thus far. The project is really, I guess, divided. They solicited for an oral historian to capture the interviews, but it's a short project that it's only 160 hours.
Yeah.
So after that, I don't know that I will actually be involved in how they transform these into what they put on the site and if the site will change and this or that.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Thank
you. Good talking to you.
Have a good afternoon.
Okay.
Bye now.
Bye.